everybody. What is going on? This is About What Matters. I'm Casey Pizzali, creator of Slacky Brown, and with me as always, I'm A-Man Connor from New York. What's up?
What's up, man? Happy New Year. Good to talk to you again.
Live from Charlottesville, dude. This is the first pod from the new HQ.
Yeah, new HQ. That's sick.
In the Ville, Central Virginia. Stand up.
Charlottesville. What's that city like? Tell me a little
bit. University of Virginia is the center of everything.
Yeah, it's a college town then.
It's a college town, but it's like a lot of history. You know, Thomas Jefferson's, this was his big idea, this University of Virginia thing. Nice. So it's a very, I don't know if colonial is the right word, but it's,
I like it though. I know what you mean. Yeah. That's cool.
And they have a lot of not weird traditions, like very specific traditions at at University of Virginia. They, it's not called a campus, it's called grounds. You're not a junior, you're a third year. You're not a senior, you're a fourth year. So very specific stuff. They'll peg you they'll know you didn't go here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's old school.
So I guess I'm a townie now. I don't know if I didn't go there.
Yeah, definitely.
Only on the townies?
Man, nothing like those people, man. The best.
For sure.
When I think of college town, I think of upstate New York, where it's like, what was it, like 2/3 of the population left when college was out of, when they weren't in session or whatever?
Dude, that's what I always think of too, Oneonta. And down here, like when there's no one on campus, it's like not quite a ghost town because it's still a pretty decent sized city, but like the areas by the school, like the corner is like the big bar spot, and there's like, it's not crowded as fuck. But
right.
So we're back, man. We're gonna run through all this important pop culture, TV and film business right now. I got something to start with.
Cool.
And I want to hear what you're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So did you hear about Aaron Sorkin's new film? Aaron Sorkin is teamed up with Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem to do a Lucy and Desi flick. It's I wouldn't call it a biopic. It's like a section of their life. You know what I mean? It's not like, sometimes they do that.
Like a snapshot.
Yeah. Snapshot. Sorkin coming off of Trial of the Chicago 8, I think it was called. That was a really good film.
Chicago 7, yeah.
Chicago 7, yeah.
I liked it. He's become, I was never into West Wing, right? Did you ever get into West Wing?
No, I never got into West Wing either.
But since...
A few Good Men is my...
Yeah, since like Moneyball and Social Network, it's been like really exciting to see what he's going to do and what he is setting up. This project, I don't really... Like, are you
I Love Lucy, man.
I Love Lucy. I was going to say Everybody Loves Lucy. That's Raymond.
Well, there was so many Lucy shows. There was like Lucy Comedy Hour and Lucy this and Lucy that.
Were you a fan of the show?
Of course, dude. Growing up, Nick at Night.
Yeah.
Hello.
Right.
Happy Days and Wonder Years and Lucy.
I'm intrigued, but I don't really have much like affiliation, or I don't really have a point in my life where I was like obsessed with I Love Lucy. But well, it's Aaron Sorkin, so you like have to,
Yeah, it's gonna be the bomb. He like takes real life stuff and makes it dope.
Right.
Are you familiar with the chocolate eating scene?
Of course, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. My grandma loved that. Yeah.
How about the first YouTube
she ever pulled up was what's the chocolate? Yeah, it's classic.
There's one where she's doing a commercial, and she's taste testing this like medicine, but it's got alcohol in it, so she keeps taking it. She keeps getting drunker and drunker. Yeah, it's so funny. Yeah. Vitamina Megamin.
In that, yeah, exactly. In that sense, it's timeless shit. It's like timeless, almost slapstick comedy.
Yes.
And also, funny relationship stuff too. You know, it's like that kind of never gets old. The relationship sitcom thing. I mean, they've been doing it for years after I Love Lucy, but. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm intrigued. It's Bardem and who did you say?
Nicole Kidman.
Kidman, okay.
Coming off The Undoing, which she killed it.
Right. Everyone loves The Undoing.
It's just high drama, dude. Prestige television.
I feel like HBO has one of those in the bank ready to go at any moment where they have like, if they're like, oh, our next season isn't that strong, we have this like crime drama ready to go.
Coming up.
You know what I mean? Like Night Of, that reminds me of Night Of. There's like dozens.
There's some misses in there.
Outsider.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Last year. Yeah.
That was all right. Mosaic was a miss.
Yeah.
The Soderbergh miniseries there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a miss. It's like okay to watch, but it didn't get traction at all. It was like a choose your own adventure type shit. It like hadn't happened. It was all weird.
Right.
Back to The Undoing for one second. If you are like, you see Hugh Grant and you think of like, what is it? Notting Hill and like,
right. the British rom-com
the rom-com world.
Yeah.
This is a dynamite Hugh Grant performance. He's on a run of really good dramatic performances. Florence Foster Jenkins, he is so good in. What was the other one recently? Oh, The Gentleman. He's really good in The Gentleman too.
Okay.
What's that gentleman's name that directed it? The dude from
Guy Ritchie.
You know his name.
Guy Ritchie. Yeah. That's right. I forgot about The Gentleman actually.
It's funny. Matthew McConaughey. It's good film.
It's funny when, you know, how old is Hugh Grant now? Probably like he's 60.
Fuck out of here, yeah. Really?
Yeah, he's 60. He was born in 60. So it's funny when you get to a certain point in your career as an older man, particularly older males and women too. There's like a third act of your career that can really be fun and exciting if you're like self-aware, you know, and know what your strengths or weaknesses are and specifically how you look, you know. I'm thinking of people like Jack Lemmon and like, okay, you know, those kind of guys. Whereas, and even talking about Soderbergh and Clooney, I'm thinking like Elliot Gould in Ocean's 11.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's what this Hugh Grant kind of revival reminds me of, is he's like putting together this third act where he's like an older gentleman now, but still has chops and like is doing different shit, you know?
Yeah, he's not like, I watched the Vanity Fair when they do like two actors, actor on actor.
Yeah, those
and
are cool.
He's like, it was him and Colin Farrell, and he's like, my fame is like way down right now, but I'm cool with it. You know, it's better. Like at one point he was a heartthrob, but now he's like cool being older man, you know?
Exactly. I think, I think the same could be said for George Clooney in a couple of years, you know, he's not quite there yet, but like Elliot Gould too. He was like a sex symbol in the 70s. And then later in their career, Jack Lemmon, same thing. Like I said, I just find like the guys that you gravitate toward as far as actors go, when they get to the later part of their career, they do interesting and sometimes funny and like fun shit, you know. Paul Newman's a great example. Like,
or it could be with what's his face? It's the opposite. With Hugh Grant, it's the opposite.
Right.
You know, he's going dramatic.
Oh yeah, right.
But Elliot Gould.
Yeah.
He's known by most people our age as Monica's dad and Friends.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like you kind of do something different. Certainly. Right.
I just think there's like the opportunities kind of open up again. Yeah, that's exciting. I gotta check it out. I'm slacking on that front. But I just did subscribe to HBO Max, which is really quite a streaming service. If you know, among the top three, I would say, of the streaming services.
HBO Max is tight. And speaking of its streaming services, are you a Gladiator guy? I'm really not. I remember seeing it, and I was too young to probably like
the Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay.
That movie rules still.
Ridley Scott and Joaquin Phoenix are teaming up again. In the next piece of news, little deadline creeping here, getting all the good headlines. Ridley Scott and Joaquin Phoenix are teaming up again for a Napoleon Bonaparte joint. Apple bought it. It's called Kit Bag. Anything from Joaquin Phoenix is actually, some things could be a little bit not as mainstream as. You know, Joaquin Phoenix is a killer actor. What was that? What was the one that he did a couple years ago?
There's one I went to the theater to see that was like an indie that he did. You Were Never Really Here.
You Were Never Really Here. That's the one I was thinking of. So it's like,
that's a cool movie. It didn't quite land, but it's Lynn Ramsey directed it, which is, she's really kind of made a name for herself, you know, since 2011. I think We Need to Talk About Kevin, I think was the name of that movie. But it was a cool movie, you know.
It was a cool movie, but it's not like as mainstream as I'm sure a Ridley Scott film is going to be.
Right. Definitely a little bit more like indie obscure.
Yeah.
But Joaquin is, I mean, he's one of the best actors working. He's a top three actor working currently, maybe the best of our generation, you know? So anytime he's attached to a project, you have to pay attention, you know. Joker, since The Master, really, is the one I think we were pointing to.
Like, Master's Killer, Her.
Her is an unbelievable movie.
Don't Worry, you know, Won't Get Far on Foot is really good. He kills it in that film.
Inherent Vice is like one I come back to quite a bit that I adore, that I can't, you know, it gets better every time I watch it. But
that was one of the only movies I watched, and then right after that I watched it again.
Yeah.
There was so much shit that I was like, okay, I gotta figure this out.
Right. Yeah. I saw it twice when it in theaters actually, which I almost never do.
All right, last piece of news. Brendan Fraser to star in Darren Aronofsky's film version of The Whale.
Oh, man, I just read about this. I'm like, couldn't be more intrigued.
I love that this guy goes and gets, like, he's the ultimate put-on guy. Like, he put Mickey Rourke back on the map with
right.
the wrestler.
Right.
He's about to put Brendan Fraser on the map. Like, he's on the map, but he's, like, kind of like a, not a laughingstock, but he's not kind of like, he's Brendan Fraser. He's George of the Jungle. He's
right, right. You know, Mummy, etc. Yeah,
he's gonna star in this like A-list film that could get critical acclaim. That's dope. I'm happy that you know they went that route. A little bit offbeat to star someone, star Brendan Fraser in a role like that. Now,
I love the pick though, because like you said with Mickey Rourke and the wrestler, it's like Aronofsky sees something that we don't see, obviously. You know,
Tarantino has been doing that forever too. He put Travolta right. back on Pulp Fiction, and
that's right. And like the great, really great directors do that. You know, I love Aronofsky's stuff, and you know it's going to be intense. I think who wrote the? Is it a book or a play?
It's not. So it's not the one. When I saw The Whale, I'm like, oh, it must be about like Call of the Wild or something like that. But
right,
it's about this guy who's like eating himself to death.
The guy who wrote the source material is, I think, writing the script. Yeah, it's a play. Samuel D. Hunter, Mormon Country, Idaho. Like I said off the jump, I'm just like really intrigued by the casting of Brendan Fraser, like in an Aronofsky movie. It's not something you'd expect, even with the, you know, the Mickey Rourke casting and in the wrestler. It's like I wish Aronofsky made a movie like one a year. He's one of those guys for me. He doesn't make nearly enough.
The last one he made is kind of a flop in my mind.
Mother
was like,
yeah, I didn't,
did we just watch?
Yeah. I didn't mind it as much as a lot of people did. I remember, talking to a few friends after they had seen it and them being like, what the fuck? But I watched it. And I was like, oh, like, you know, it's a Bible story, you know, it's like,
an allegory.
Yeah. And I thought Jennifer Lawrence was tremendous, and actually all the performances. Michelle Pfeiffer, like, she's really sick in it. But yeah, Aronofsky's just he's that kind of guy that since Black Swan, really. I mean, I can't say I watch Requiem for a Dream too often. Yeah. It's a dark hole that you don't really want to go down. But since Black Swan, I'm just like, man, this guy needs to do more, you know.
Okay, so moving on to best film I've seen all year and probably within the last year as well. Pieces of a Woman. This is a review from Jack Cameron. Pieces of a Woman is a difficult watch, but there are incredibly powerful performances alongside possibly the most unforgettable opening sequence of recent years.
Yeah.
So it doesn't give too much away, that review, and it's totally accurate. Spoiler alert now, I'm not going to watch what I say. The film starts out with it's almost inverted, where the highest drama is coming within the first half hour of the film, and then it kind of you wean off of it the rest of the way, and then it picks back up again a little bit at the end. But so it's the scene that everyone's talking about. It's a 23-minute one shot continuous run, and it's a birth scene. Before we get into that, what were your thoughts on the film?
Yeah, I think the review kind of, you just read, summed it up, and even your thoughts after that. It's like, you know, before you even see the title screen, it's not even that it's graphic. Like you said, it's a one shot. I thought I saw some masked cuts in there, but maybe not. It is a difficult watch, like you said. It's not one that I would probably ever revisit because of that, you know. It's like the opening scene, let's start there, is like a masterful work of film direction, you know, and the performances are off the charts, and it's like a literal worst nightmare scenario for a
young couple,
a young couple expecting a child, you know? So immediately you're off on this kind of foot where, you know, I'm sure there are other films that have depicted childbirth or depicted, there are young mothers losing a child at birth, but this one felt like real people that have real problems.
Very verite.
Verite style. Yeah, exactly. But it just felt like it's not a fucking fairy tale. It's not like a, you know, these are people, I think it was set in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Boston. And it was like so un-Boston.
Yeah. And like, but like also, you know, working class families that like, you know, Shia buys a minivan and like the second scene or whatever, or, you know, it felt real in those ways. The characters felt fleshed out as far as low middle class aspiring new parents that had just gone through a tragedy. And that's really what the whole movie is. And it's tough. You know, it's heartbreaking. Truly,
it's hard to come back from. Like, you put yourself in that position and you're like, I don't know if, like, you got to have a really strong relationship to make it through. And I even think they did have that, but it's just like certain people are wired different ways and certain people can react differently to tragedy. Both of them went off the rails a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you said, you know, it's not a fairy tale, and it's totally true. That's was one of the things that I love the most. There's a scene later in the film where, essentially, Ellen Burstyn, who delivers a great performance.
She's great. Yeah. Talking about Aronofsky. Yeah.
She essentially makes an offer to buy Shia out of, like, here's as much money as you want. Get out of here.
Right.
And in so many, 99 out of 100 films, there's going to be some sort of love, romantic thing where they're not going to take the money. They're going to take the girl. They're going to go with the love.
Right.
But in this film, like, no, there is a price right now. There's a price on, like, we're not connected that well anymore.
Mm.
I don't have a lot of money. I'm going through some shit. There's enough money that's going to make me just say, you know what, turn the page, chapter's over, mm-hmm. I'm gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it has took a lot of stones to even make that happen. Like,
right.
Everyone's expecting them to, like, at that point, like, no, we're not going to.
Right. I think
you buy me out of this family.
That's a good point. I think the final penultimate scene is the two sisters and the mother having coffee and tea or whatever, you know, lunch together. And, you know, when you get to that scene where Ellen Burstyn's character is trying to get Shia LaBeouf's character out of the picture, you know, like you said, you expect the cutoff to be, you know, the mother, because she's been kind of an antagonist towards the two of them the entire film, mm-hmm. up to that point. You know, you expect the relationship to cut off this poisonous limb or whatever you want to say, and kind of get her out of the picture so that they can, you know, come together as a couple and be, you know, she's kind of the wedge driving between them. But like you said, it kind of subverts your expectations as far as that goes. And then, you know, in the penultimate scene, we see the daughters and Ellen Burstyn having lunch, and Vanessa Kirby's character grab, you know, her mother's hand in like a loving way. And it's like, oh, ultimately, yeah, they're subverting your expectation, but probably the right decision too, you know?
Yeah.
It's just interesting as far as that goes. As far as a script and what you're expecting to see after a couple goes through the grief and, you know, devastation of losing a child at birth, it's not therapy. It's not like they go through it, you know, and that's what you're seeing. You're going through it with them.
I was also team midwife throughout. I'm like, yo.
Yeah.
Tough. She did what she could, man. Like, go on.
No, yeah, you're right. That was another interesting part too. Is like, you know, a bit of commentary on the legal system, not too much, you know, not hitting you over the head with it, although there was some imagery that was hitting you over the head.
Yeah. Well, Ellen Burstyn's like, if you did it my way, you'd be holding your baby right now.
Right.
There must have been a choice. You know, I know some people like to I'd like to do it at home, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's
spiritual there or something.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think it is like a natural bohemian, for lack of a better term.
Yeah,
way of,
for sure.
You know, it's natural, and people like to, you know, be comfortable in their. I get it. There's kind of a movement towards it too.
So a film like this that's so powerful, but also like not a rewatchable movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to see more of that in film? There's still a world where that works.
Yeah. Definitely.
Right.
Especially when you're as gifted a filmmaker as this gentleman is. I'm not even going to attempt to say his name, but
he's Hungarian. I know that much.
Yeah. I mean, I think these come around once in a while. You know, if you have your ear to the indie festivals and et cetera, these are out there, and the reason they don't get picked up or whatever, distributed by a major studio, is because there is no rewatchability factor to them, you know. But these are out there. There's a few indies a year that are devastating that you almost don't even want to think about again.
And,
you know.
Scorsese co-signed it also, what came out as an EP, just to help the film get a little bit more traction. So
you get the seal of approval from Marty.
Yeah. So this was a stage play first over there. It had to do with the director and his wife. They wrote it together. Some true real life stuff in there. What are some of your favorite, we mentioned A Few Good Men before, plays that became films?
Okay. There are a handful of kind of legendary ones, I would say, that you kind of have to point to. Sound of Music being one of them. The other one I'm thinking of is Bob Fosse's Cabaret. Cabaret is unbelievable.
How about take musical out of it?
The one I think of is none other than the great David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross.
That's what I had.
This is another example, like kind of what you were talking about, like these indie pictures that, like, you know, aren't necessarily mainstream art, but like I've found myself watching more and more movies lately and being more open to these like little contained stories that aren't, you know, may not be consequential to the pop culture sphere, so to speak. Glengarry Glen Ross is a perfect example of that. It's not like there's not a lot that happens. It's literally like
two days or a day and a half.
Yeah, it's just dudes swinging, throwing their fastballs. It's
like a business transaction.
Yeah, this is the kind of movies that, you know, I think what the more you look at movies and understand why people make movies or like understand even someone like David Mamet, why he would write such a thing, it's like the more open you are to accepting it as a piece of art, in whether it's an hour and a half or, you know, eight episodes at an hour each.
Tremendous. Well, if you have fantastic dialogue and good performances,
yeah,
it's going to make it go.
Exactly.
There's nothing better in life than having, you know, sitting, you feel better after having a great conversation. So it's entertaining to watch intelligent people talk and good actors recite intelligent writers' words.
Exactly. I'd love to see that one on stage. I wish I could. Especially if there were one or two big names attached to it, it would be really fun to see on Broadway.
I remember watching Fences a couple years ago too. That was another one that I know was a.
That's right. Yeah.
Was an older play. I think I can't think of the name right now, but the latest Chadwick Boseman performance was
Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yeah,
that's Netflix. Okay,
that's same deal as Fences.
August Wilson play. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you have any others? Do you wanted to? Because I can't really. Are there others
off the top of my head?
Yeah.
I know Mammoth's done more than just Glenn. He's had more than just Glengarry go from stage to film.
Right.
I'm having a thought. Figure out right now. The Bronx Tale. Bronx Tale was Chaz Palminteri wrote it
right
in like the 80s, and then the movie was in the early 90s.
Okay,
and he was in it. The Bronx Tale.
Cuckoo's Nest was a play too. The Milos Forman movie.
You can always tell if there's no like gigantic set pieces with big action sequences. You know, the good chances are someone. It was on stage at some point.
Which, like, it's if it's done right, I think there was an actual, Cormac McCarthy wrote that Tommy Lee Jones and was it Samuel L. Jackson were in?
Sunshine something. Sunrise. Sunshine.
Sun.
It was like they were just in the same room.
Limited something.
Sunset Limited,
right. So there's, which eventually became a film for HBO, I think.
Yeah, that's where I saw that on HBO.
I think Tommy Lee actually directed it too, but you know, some of them are, you can tell, actually, this is funny that you bring this up because some of them you can really tell that they were written for the stage. And if, like you said, if there's no major kind of set piece or action or even different locations, you can tell, and it feels a little strange, but, Regina King's new movie, One Night in Miami.
Oh yeah. That's the, Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X and
Sam Cooke there's some, I guess the initial responses that she's kind of answering to now is that it's just a filmed play, which I'm not sure what the source material is. It might've been a play, but you know, sometimes it's okay to do a filmed version of the play. You know what I mean? Like almost The Hateful Eight could have been a stage play, you know?
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, there's no,
if you're contained in the haberdashery, it's like that, you know, I would love to see a stage version of it. In fact, but like sometimes if it works, then it works, you know.
Good story, good performance, man. That's
That's really all it takes.
Writing, directing, acting. It's always the magic formula. So this past Sunday was the first half of Tiger. Much anticipated Tiger Woods documentary on HBO. Second half coming up this Sunday. Thoughts on the first? It's definitely not something that I think Tiger Woods is on board with. Judging from who he's digging of all the characters that was passed.
Not authorized.
No. What do you think? Where are you at on it?
I will consume anything about Tiger that until we get the authorized doc, you know, the Last Dance style 10 episode HBO version or whatever it is, you know, this offered some perspective on things that I'm not sure I was fully aware of. I think you got to take some things with a grain of salt. Obviously it's not, you know, it's not coming from the horse's mouth or the tiger's mouth, so to speak. But look, there are clips and backstory and kind of emotional or psychological backstory that does shine a bit of a light on Tiger the Man.
About any 1-year-old or 2-year-old, you know, and then
look
back and see what he was doing.
Exactly.
2 years old. He has had the same swing then as 2 years old as he does now.
Remarkable stuff.
Hitting the ball straight, you know, on command. It's like
amazing.
Unbelievable.
I think that's one of the things I took from it was how amazing he was at two. You know, he's probably hitting the ball farther than I am currently. the other thing is the daddy issues, so to speak, the smothering influence of Earl, that I'm not sure I fully understood. Like I said, I think it's right at the top of the doc, you hear Earl say, you know, my son is a gift to humanity or something crazy.
Yeah, the humanitarian stuff.
Oh no. Like how much pressure did he put on his son, you know? And the other thing was just the domination from the amateur championships right up until his first, like right through his first Masters, you know.
He was as advertised, man.
It was as advertised, and that's so rare in the sports world. You know, LeBron James was another that was as advertised. But that's such a rare thing, and to see and to be reminded with the clips and the scores, like you mentioned, the numbers he was winning by, it was just, it's insane, and that stuff's cool. So I'm here for it. I'm excited for part two.
So we'll both definitely be watching it on Sunday. And just a quick shout out to another HBO sports documentary that I was like, I don't know if we need this, but I did enjoy the CeCe Sabathia documentary on HBO.
Yeah, I haven't checked it out yet, but
like, is CeCe big enough to warrant one? I don't think so, but it was a good enough story. And I was like, okay, this is a cool hour and a half to spend. I always like CeCe, and he's doing well now with his podcast and stuff. So
yeah, he's great. Let me ask you, when do you think we get the authorized Tiger doc? Like when he's retired, when he's 60, when we're 60, or when do you think that comes? Like,
I don't think he even cares. I don't know, but it might never come.
Maybe.
You know what I'm saying? Like, look at the press conference he ran after he had all his issues. It was like so buttoned up and so sanitized. Like, I don't know if we get it, it might not be what we're looking for anyway.
Right. Right. So, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. He's not.
Those guys have so much to protect. You know, I don't know if it. Guarding your legacy is one thing. I think it depends. You know, if he like gets on another role again, possible. But I also want to say this, the fact that he was able to win that Masters last year. That was like,
yeah,
that was good enough for me. Like that was, he came back and he did it after all those years of, you know, struggling and back problems and some minor drug issues. And like, yep. he came back and he won the fucking Masters. Like
that's right. Yeah.
That's such a great story.
That's a remarkable ending in itself. And he's not done yet, but we can all kind of go, you know, it's funny because he took the golf world by storm and everyone collectively was rooting for him. Even I think a lot of people, even after all his troubles and the mugshot and all of that, still were like, we want, you know, we want to see the return of the great Tiger Woods, you know, and we got it. In 2019, we got it. And that's just, it's just amazing.
It's a story as old as time.
Yeah.
We as humans don't appreciate things while we have them. And then when they're gone, we're like, oh man, you know, I wish I could get a taste of that. So, you know, we saw Tiger Woods be great for so long and then it just turned off like a faucet. And we're like, man, want to see that again. I just want to get another taste of that. And that's what it was. And it was a great story. And I have a picture that's going to go up in the office here of the Sports Illustrated cover of when he won it. One of my favorite pictures.
That's a great one. Yeah. That's an all-time great Sports Illustrated cover for sure.
But all right, guys, that's the show. We're going to be back. We're going to try to do one a week or one every 2 weeks, but we're back. So thanks for listening. As always, SackyBrown.com. Check us out. Appreciate it. Thanks for sticking. Bye.
All right, Case.